couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies include A Quiet Place, Isle of Dogs, Blockers, Chappaquiddick, and The Miracle Season. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Now, I know I don't really cover television news because there's so much TV out there, I don't have time to watch it because I'm out there watching movies. So I used to watch a ton of TV, but when I would review much more of the seasons of DVDs, I used to have a huge slate on my DVR, and it took a lot of time, let me tell you. But every now and then, something's interesting on TV, or it's part of the national conversation. And obviously, big shows like Stranger Things or the Marvel series, or even when they get, Arrested Development came back, or when Mystery Science Theater was back, that certainly has a crossover potential between movies and television. I mean, something like Mystery Science Theater certainly exists as both a television show and a movie series as well. But every now and then I like to talk about specifically about television. And this week I want to address the big TV news, which is that return of Roseanne, the TV series that, of course, was big. I mean, huge in the late 80s throughout the 90s was a massive juggernaut in terms of ratings machine. And then eventually it got canceled and it got buried in the sand for 10,000 years, as Belloc would say to Indiana Jones, and now it has resurfaced. Now, what's interesting about it is it is huge. It had something like an over 18 million viewers, just live viewers, on its premiere, which was a two-part. It's not really two-part. It was just they showed two episodes back-to-back. So the first night, last week, it had 18 million people, and it was over 20 million when you get into DVRs and delayed viewings, and it was like a 5 million share. I mean, it did very, very well, and it's a huge hit for ABC, which is struggling in the ratings mainly because they don't have the professional sports that, like, say, Fox or CBS has, so they're suffering a bit in terms of, like, ranked network, and this is a huge boon for ABC, and one of the things that's kind of sparked sort of the national conversation is why it did so well. Well, it's never what an episode does. It's what subsequent episodes do. I remember back in the 90s when Ellen had her show, when Ellen DeGeneres had her show, and she was coming out. It was like a huge thing. It was the episode where she comes out and admits she's gay. And that one had huge numbers. And I forget how long after that episode aired that the Ellen show lasted. It wasn't very long. And the reason was is because, first of all, making it a serious show about a woman coming to terms with being a lesbian was not what the show originally was. It would be like if Jerry Seinfeld had come out in his show and came out as gay. Well, that's not what Seinfeld was about. So when it changed the timbre of the show and then they started to try and deal with it more of an issue, people lost interest. They got very interested in that one episode. And then everything trickled away from that point on. And I'm thinking that that's probably what's going to happen with Roseanne. Now, they had their second week and they still had like 15 million viewers. And that's really good. That's a great hold from week to week. And there are some people are saying, well, because her character's a Trump supporter and they're trying to infuse now. I mean, even the president's out there claiming credit for this. When if you really look, it was just the first episode, a two-part season premiere. That's the only time they really mention, even come close to swerving into actual politics. And it's just the fact that Roseanne and her sister Jackie are at other ends of the political spectrum in terms of who they voted for. But even then, when you hear them talk about why they want, you know, why Jackie was a Hillary supporter and why Roseanne's character was a Trump supporter, it was the most surface level of description. Well, because she's a woman. Well, because he's going to shake things up. They don't really discuss politics in this. And they're trying to be relevant almost to the point of annoyance because they're cramming so many issues in here. I say you got to get past this first. See how this settles down. When we get to episode 5 or 6, that's where we're going to kind of see where maybe it settles. But it's never going to reach that 18 million viewer number again, because that's at the top. And that's a great place to start. But we'll see if they can sustain it. The other thing we got to watch out for, that Roseanne has to watch out for, and she's already stepped in a couple bear traps, is this is different now than it was in the 90s, where you can really expose yourself as a kook very quickly with a Twitter account. And Roseanne's always been kind of bonkers anyways, and she smokes a lot of weed, and she is very outspoken in terms of her politics, but it's out there and you can search it and find it. And it's just a matter of time before she says something stupid that really torpedoes her show. Also, we'll see what happens with the internal struggles, because you got Sarah Gilbert, who's very different politically than Roseanne is, and you've also got people like Wanda Sykes involved in the show, and I don't know where the power struggles all lie behind, because Roseanne, when she did the show in the 90s, she was well known for getting rid of people and changing it. We'll see how much power she has with like somebody like Gilbert, who was instrumental in getting the show back on the air. I don't think the story's finished with Roseanne in terms of the behind the scenes stuff, and we'll see how that impacts stuff later on. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Cargo, which is a Netflix movie. Opens on October 6th.
You're the first people I've seen. The first people who are still people.
They're setting out hunting parties. If you want to give this baby a second chance, you just stay away.
We gotta find a clever man. If you're sick, he can give you good medicine.
We're here. So when things get back to normal, it's not gonna happen, is it?
I don't think normal's on the horizon.
This one stars Martin Freeman, who, of course, is best known. Well, now he's best known because he was in Black Panther, but also he was in the Hobbit movies, and he's in the Sherlock show from the BBC. He's a big name now, and I mean, he's been around for decades. But this is him basically sort of in this zombie apocalypse, I guess, in Australia. This is done by the people who did The Babadook, which was a great movie. And that gives it promise. My worry is, of course, with a movie like this, is while it looks like it has some promise, is it going to just turn into misery porn? Which is what ends up happening a lot with these zombie films. So I'm holding out hope that it's going to be decent. But I'm also not holding out too much hope that I'm going to get my hopes too high. But I'll watch this in October, and it'll be great because it's a horror movie. I mean, at least it has horror elements, and it's an October movie, which is time to watch horror movies, in my opinion. The next one I want to talk about is Johnny English Strikes Again, which opens on September 20th.
We have a problem.
Good.
The identities of our serving agents have been exposed.
The country is in a state of complete chaos.
And the universe sends me you.
She's the key to this case.
I'm not sure I've ever met a man quite like you.
Let me clear up the uncertainty for you. You haven't.
The agent you've got in the field is making some progress.
Target acquired.
This is, of course, the third Johnny English movie. Not a whole lot of people in America care about this series because it's kind of flopped in the States. This is a great example of one of those movies that people who only follow North American box office don't understand that these are big hits. Rowan Atkinson's an international superstar, and the first two Johnny English movies did like $150 million worldwide or $160 million and certainly overperformed based on their budget. Now, most of that money came from overseas. And here's a great example of why America is not the only place that drives movies. And this isn't even just a China market. This is the British market and the European market. This is not made for American audiences. It's just coming out here. It's more or less a courtesy. I love Mr. Bean, and this is sort of like Mr. Bean does James Bond. So I like the second better than the first one, so maybe this one might even be better. Who knows? Rowan Atkinson is an acquired taste, and I do enjoy his comedy. So I am looking forward to this in September. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Blockers and Chappaquiddick.
Shirt, too it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the movies that are out this week. First off is Blockers. The parents of three high school girls mobilized to stop their daughters from following through with a pact to lose their virginity on prom night.
I used to hold that girl in the palm of my hand.
Kayla's becoming a woman. You're going to have to deal with that.
Tonight is the first night of our adult lives. I want to go to prom and lose my virginity.
Prom night. It's kind of perfect.
I'm in.
Julie left her laptop open.
What?
Our girls are not thinking things through. I'm going to stop them.
I'm in.
This is essentially a gender swap of the sort of teen comedies. It's something like American Pie. If you remember American Pie from 1999, that was these three high school kids, I think three or four high school boys who made it their mission to lose their virginity before the end of their senior year in high school. And that was the story. And it led to this bizarre, goofy, abroad comedy with, you know, sex jokes. And it was essentially kind of like when Porky's did this back in the 80s, where the whole thing was to get Pee-wee to lose his virginity. And we've seen these movies before. And John Cena plays one of the parents, and he's actually very funny. But he's never headlined a movie aside from that animated Bull movie that came out last year. But in terms of headlining a comedy, he hasn't. And I don't think he can't. I just think that he hasn't proved himself that way. And then they've got Ike Barinholtz, who you most might recognize from the Mindy Project. He's very funny in a lot of things he does. And he was in the Neighbors movies. But then they put in Leslie Mann. And Leslie Mann, let's just face it. Can we have a conversation about how terrible Leslie Mann is? She is not funny. She's shrill. And the only reason she's got a career past her 30s, when she got past her, you know, sort of like model good looks. And then she would just put in every Judd Apatow movie he had. Why? Because she's his wife. And she's not funny. She's never been funny. I know there's some people who like her, but everything I've seen her in, everything from the Judd Apatow movies like This Is 40, all the way to, was that The Other Woman that she was in with Cameron Diaz a couple of years ago, and now she's in this. She's not funny. And she thinks she is, and I think there's a contingency that says, well, she's been in movies that have done well in spite of her. But she's awful. Terrible. I cannot stand Leslie Mann as an actress. So she's one of the anchor stars in this, and it feels like it's kind of cast with, like, second fiddle people. I mean, Ike Barinholtz is very funny, but he's always kind of been a side character or a supporting character. And John Cena has always, at least in a comedy, in movies like the Daddy's Home films or Trainwreck, has been that supporting character who has a knack for comedy, but I don't know whether he's going to be able to carry it. Now, the girls who play the daughters, they're funny. The one girl who plays John Cena's daughter, she's an Indian girl, and she's actually very funny. The problem is the writing's not very good. A lot of the jokes don't land. A lot of they're old jokes. I mean, they're making Siri jokes. They're making jokes about the one of their stepfathers can't use the camera, and he keeps having the camera flip the wrong way on this phone. I'm like, that's like a 2010 joke. It's in a movie coming out in 2018. It's got emoji jokes in there, which, again, we've been there and done that. So it recycles a lot of humor, and the raunchiness, it's sort of like when you watch a stand-up routine and somebody's just dropping the F-bomb, and there's nothing funny about the F-bomb. There's nothing funny about using crass words. It's how you make those words work. Now, you can listen to George Carlin, old stand-up, and he's a poetry to his swearing. It's how you use them, not just using them. It's how you use them. You can't just drop it. It's easy to drop an F-bomb. Anyone can do that. But to make that F-bomb funny, that's a different story. And so they use, a lot of crass language in here that's just thrown in there to be crass and not actually have a punchline. It's just like, oh, let's put a swear word in there and that's the joke. So it doesn't work. It's not a funny movie. It has funny bits in it, but it's not a good movie. But what's funny is I came home and I looked at some of the reviews that were out there, and people are going bonkers about this. And by people, I mean critics, because it has yet to be proved out there in the marketplace. But critics are giving it really high marks. And consistently what I'm seeing is it's not that it's getting high marks because it's funny. It's getting high marks because it's empowering to women, and isn't it great to see a movie about teenage girls having sex instead of teenage guys having sex. And again, like when what happened with Neighbors 2, if you remember that movie, which got all this acclaim from some of these neo-feminist critics, it ended up not performing well in the marketplace. And my problem with like Neighbors 2 wasn't that it was girls having sex. It was because they were just all sleazy. There was no substance behind it. It was just like, oh, well, we see these movies where these guys are being raunchy and gross, and so let's make the girls raunchy and gross. But what they don't realize, and I said this back when I reviewed Neighbors 2, is in a lot of these movies, the most crass people in the ones that are raunchy and gross, are it's a downplayed character. And in fact, it's seen as a character flaw in guys in movies to be overly promiscuous and just trying to bed women. I mean, yeah, you get the over-the-top silly archetypes like a James Bond character, but if you go back to American Pie, the moral of American Pie was it's not just about sex. There's a lot more to it, and maybe you're not old enough for it, and that's the point of American Pie. And even if you go back to, like, another great example is Tony Stark in Iron Man. His promiscuity is seen as a character flaw that he overcomes. And you see that in other movies where, you know, they come out the other end and they become monogamous. They become a better person. They become more caring and more emotionally attached, and they aren't just out there to conquest. That's the stuff that's missing. That's the stuff that was missing in Neighbors 2. And that's the stuff that's missing in this movie. They're just like, oh, look, girls can have sex too. Well, okay, yeah, but it's going for that liberation, but no consequence to it. And that comes hand in hand. And that stuff is not lost. And even a movie like Porky's, I mean, Porky's, as much as a teen sex comedy as it was, there was a lot more to Porky's than just about some kid trying to get laid in high school. And that's important in a movie. And they kind of throw that to the wind. And you know, if you're seeing this just because you're like, oh, yay, girls can have sex too, liberation, I don't think that that's what audiences are out to see. Plus, this movie gets really preachy at some points, and that's when it really falls off the rails, is when inside the movie it decides to preach its own message, which I'm like, if you have to do that, if you have to hit the pause button in a movie to spell out your message, you're not doing it right. Ultimately, that leads me to say that Blockers sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's quickly look at Chappaquiddick, which wasn't screened. The scandal that took down Ted Kennedy is re-examined in this historical drama.
We have a situation here on Chappaquiddick.
There's been an accident. We can't find Mary Jo.
I was driving.
Do you have any idea? Court of public opinion will have your head on a stake.
We tell the truth, or at least our version of it.
I want you to know that every effort possible was made to save her.
What do we do to help the senator?
A dead body holds a lot of secrets. Those can be the difference between guilt and innocence.
Are you saying that there's a possibility that maybe she didn't drown?
So this is a replay of the Chappaquiddick incident and sort of giving the backstory to it. I'm not exactly sure how accurate it is. I mean, I get my history from movies. So, I mean, I thought that the gladiator fought the Roman emperor in the Colosseum to win the heart of Rome. So I couldn't tell you whether this is accurate or not. I haven't even seen it. They didn't screen it. Now, that may or may not be good, because not screening a movie is a bad idea. But in a movie like this, I can see it's a smaller studio, so, you know, maybe that's a good reason. But who knows? I'm curious to see it. Maybe I'll check it out on home video. I don't even think it's going to reach in the top 10 this week. So it's a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about A Quiet Place and The Miracle Season. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. The big one that's going to be probably topping the box office this week is A Quiet Place. In the not-too-distant future, a family tries to survive living in a world haunted by vicious creatures that hunt by sound.
We have to protect them.
as you can tell by the trailer, there's not a whole lot of dialogue to this movie. Now, there is dialogue because they do communicate, but they communicate in American Sign Language at times, partly because one of their kids, the characters, the kid is deaf. But that's neither here nor there, because the whole point is they're trying to be quiet because these creatures can hear even the tiniest little sound and will come after them. So there's a lot of dialogue that takes place non-verbally. And that makes it very difficult to find something for the trailer, which is why there's like 7 words in the trailer and the rest of it's noises and radio broadcasts. So this is a bona fide horror movie. And I think a lot of people are sort of billing it almost as a thriller or science fiction, sort of maybe a horror movie. It's funny because even today, even after Get Out got nominated for Oscars, and almost 30 years ago, you had Silence of the Lambs win Oscars, people are still afraid to bill things as horror movies. But this is a horror movie through and through. It's directed by John Krasinski, who also co-wrote it and stars in it with his wife, his real-life wife, Emily Blunt. And it's a smaller production because, you know, it's a very small cast. And minimal special effects, although they do have effects in there. It's another step that he's trying to take away from his Jim character from The Office. I mean, he sort of had a lock on the goofy, affable everyman. And so, you know, he did the Benghazi movie a couple years ago. He's going to be in a Jack Ryan series on Amazon coming up. And this is him trying to go more serious and creepy and intense. And this is a great directorial debut because he has all the elements that make a movie work. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago with Unsane, where he had Steven Soderbergh do a small little movie, but he still had professional actors, professional cameraman, professional lighting, professional set design. So this movie looks very professional, even though you can tell that it's a very modest production. And what makes it work as a horror movie is not just because it has the horror elements. You don't just need jump scares and monsters and effects. You need to have a human element to it. And it's because you got a man and a woman who have kids. And of course, to add things, the worst to the story, you've got the woman's pregnant in the movie. So she's going to have a baby. And we all know, anyone who's a parent knows that babies just are noisy. And there's nothing you can do about it. So that's something you know is coming, that you're going to have a little bundle of joy that also makes a lot of noise. So there's that human element of them trying to be parents and trying to save their kids. It's an intense movie, and it deals with the jump scares, but it also deals with what it's like to be a parent and to take care of and protect your kids, or try to at least. It's got some plot holes to it. I'm not going to lie. It has some plot holes and some major plot holes to it. There's some things that happen in the movie where, I mean, like stuff like I look into, they're in the woods, they're out in the nature, and people have this misconception that nature and living on a farm is quiet. And it is. You don't have necessarily, you know, street sounds and honking of horns and sirens all the time. But if you've ever spent any time on a farm, and I grew up in Ohio and I had family who lived on farms, farms are noisy. Animals and birds and insects are loud. And it is in some ways noisier on a farm with all that going on than it is in the city. I mean, you know, the city can actually get kind of quiet at night because you don't have crickets and chirping and frogs and all that kind of noise. Now, the other thing is you're watching this and they have this farm and they've got like corn growing. I'm like, how are they tilling the soil? How are they planting the farm? You can't run tractors in this world because it's going to attract the creatures. So, I mean, there are some elements in this that don't quite work. I did find myself looking at that going, well, that doesn't quite make sense. That doesn't actually work in the world that we're believing that they live in. And there's parts of it that if you think too far to it, because the whole thing is they're trapped by these creatures that have this exterior armor and they're very violent and very fast. And we're led to believe that they've kind of wiped out humanity, or at least wiped out anybody that you can connect to. And I'm like, you know, well, was there a military response? And how did this thing? There's a lot of stuff that doesn't seem to wash in terms of when you think about it on a global scale. But for this tiny little secluded farmhouse and these people trying to live, it does make sense. And that's what makes it work. Don't think too hard about it. Like one of the other things is they always walk around barefoot, because the whole point is if you can hear yourself walking, that's, you know, on shoes and that sort of thing, but they don't even have like moccasins. You know, they don't even use leather to warm their feet because it's in fall. It's clearly, you know, you got the leaves changing color. It's going to be cold and you're going to die from exposure if you're walking around in 50 degree, 40 degree weather with no shoes on, you know, regardless of how safe that is. So there's parts of it that don't work logistically, but you can look past those to just get to the story. And ultimately, it's a good film. And the biggest trouble you're going to have with this is it reminds me a little bit of The Witch that came out several years ago. Also like Don't Breathe. But Don't Breathe was more of just a straightforward suspense, home invasion-y horror movie kind of film. This reminds me a little bit of The Witch, which uses the soundtrack, and it is very quiet, and it is very deliberate. And to really enjoy it, you need to see it in a quiet room. And we all know that public movie audiences are not always quiet. So first of all, if you have a friend, if you're going to go to this movie and you have a friend or you yourself or somebody who likes to talk during a movie, don't go see this movie. Go see Ready Player One. That's loud and bombastic and you can talk and you're not even going to hear people in that. This movie, don't talk. I mean, people are coughing in the movie and you hear it and it's and it almost distracts you because it is so silent at times. But I actually went to this in a pretty crowded room, and I'd say the theater was two-thirds at least full, and you had your typical horror audience, which are, you know, teenagers and high school and college kids, and they were pretty quiet and respectable. I was in the front row, so I don't know if anyone was using their phone, but people weren't talking and people weren't making noise, and that's the kind of audience you want to see it in. So just kind of buyer beware as you go see it, because you might have a bad experience if you're in a bad audience. But still, ultimately, The Quiet Place totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Miracle Season. The death of a high school volleyball star inspires the team at the state championships.
I'd like to have a moment of silence in honor of Caroline Found.
Without their star player, West Volleyball suffered another defeat.
How's the team looking?
I ate last year.
We're not champions anymore.
We gotta find us a new captain. Everybody wanna be just like us. Talk to him. Lead.
Why me? You're a best friend. Girls are looking at you.
I'm taking her spot.
And you're making it your own.
Now, this is based on a true story, and it was also not screened for me. What's weird is I was contacted to ask if I wanted to see it, and I said, yes, send me a screener or set up a screening. And they're like, yes, we'll do that. Didn't hear anything from the studio. So apparently, I was even approached, but then they decided, and they're like, no, you don't need to see it. So how good is it? If they ask you if you want to see it and then kind of have second thoughts about you seeing it, how bad could the movie be? This looks like it's playing off of the same kind of sports inspiration that you saw in a movie like We Are Marshall. Gosh, that was almost more than 10, 12 years ago, where you've got a team that suffers a tragedy and they turn the emotion of the tragedy into a win. And while that works, and it's a true story, you are left with at least a sense from just looking at the trailer is this about winning for the girl who passes, or is it winning for the team? And I mean, it looks like it might be okay for sort of that inspirational sports movie, but then again, it's volleyball, and how exciting can volleyball get? I mean, maybe they do a good job, but I don't know. This is yet to be seen by me. So it has to get a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That is it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Isle of Dogs, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show with some movie reviews, or a movie review, and let's talk about the last movie on the docket, and that is Isle of Dogs. Wes Anderson returns to stop-motion animation in this film about a future in which the Japanese government bans all dogs following the dog flu outbreak and the mission of a 12-year-old boy who wants to find his former pet.
An outbreak of dog flu rips through the city of Megasaki. Trash Island becomes an exiled colony.
Nobody's giving up around here, and don't you forget it, ever. We're a pack of scary, indestructible alpha dogs.
Atari Kobayashi, you heroically hijacked a junior turboprop XJ-750 and flew it to the island because of your dog.
Darn it.
I've got a crush on you.
Now, first of all, I'm going to warn you, I'm going to film nerd out on this. I am a huge Wes Anderson fan. I am an unabashed Wes Anderson fan. I may not always love the directors that everyone loves in the film community. I think that Terrence Malick is a blowhard and a pretentious director, and that's flies in the face of a lot of the film community. I think Michael Haneke is way overrated as this foreign director. Again, flies in the face of the film community. But when it comes to Wes Anderson, I love his stuff. But what's funny is I don't universally love what everyone else loves. Like, generally, a lot of people consider his best movie Rushmore. And I think Rushmore's fine, but it's hardly his best movie. I actually think that that's on the lower end. His more recent stuff's the stuff I love, my favorite ones, the Royal Tenenbaums. But I love all of the stuff he's done. You know, even like Bottle Rocket, which is a little less quirky for him because it was one of his first film. But he comes back from Fantastic Mr. Fox, which was about 10 years ago, 9 years ago. He made that movie in its stop motion, a Roald Dahl book. And it was just a glorious celebration of quirky, rustic cinema. And he comes back to the stop motion element with this one. Now, his stop motion artistry has gotten better because, of course, like Fantastic Mr. Fox, which had animals in it, you had all this fur, and the fur always kind of looked like it was a little bit herky jerky. They calmed down the fur on this one. The dog's coats aren't as problematic for the animation, but it's beautifully animated, first of all. Let's just talk about the animation. It's gorgeous. It has some beautiful set pieces. And you've seen him do the miniature stop motion set pieces like The Life Aquatic, or in particular, the Grand Budapest Hotel. When that came out a couple years ago, they had these elements that showed, stop motion and miniature sets. So he does that. That's a very common thing for him to do. And so you can see a development and progression here. So it's gorgeously animated and has these beautiful sets and wonderful characters and very nuanced. But it's also just a great little movie. It's different. It is so different than anything you're going to see. And that's one of the greatest things about Wes Anderson. It's even more different than a standard Wes Anderson movie. It does have that sort of quirky, whimsical side to it that you would expect, that very dry delivery. But it's also, it's much more lavish than you normally see in a Wes Anderson movie. It has little bits and pieces, little Easter eggs and elements. And it has some really interesting characters, especially the dog characters. And it does have that dry humor of the banter back and forth. Now, I'll tell you what it's not. It's not a cute movie. It's not Benji. It's not Homeward Bound or The Incredible Journey or something like that, where it's a Disney movie that you can take little kids to. Just because it's a dog movie does not mean it's going to be fuzzy and adorable. It's PG-13. There's some scary stuff that happens in it. There's some violent stuff that happens in it. There's also stuff with the dogs that happens that maybe your diehard dog lover in your family may not like. Like, my sister's a huge dog fan, and I actually don't think she would particularly like this movie. I mean, she'll like parts of it, but there's other parts of it that, you know, there's bad things that happen to dogs, and there's jokes made to the dog's expense, and there's some violent stuff and unfortunate things, some realistic and some more comical, that I think she would take issue with because she is, you know, so passionately attached to dogs and their animals, and she loves them so much that I don't think that she would like the sort of like the more throwaway elements to this, we'll say. So she might like it, but I know she's not going to. It's not going to be the same kind of movie as you know, something like A Dog's Purpose, which was very much for dog lovers. So it's wonderfully done, and it's one of those stories that goes in so many different directions, and it's unpredictable. Now, there's a lot of criticism out there, people saying, oh, it's appropriating Japanese culture, and oh, they've got this foreign exchange student, and that's the white savior element that's problematic. I think that that's overdone in terms of criticism. I think there's a very good artistic reason why they put the exchange student in there, so they can have somebody who speaks English. It's basically the reason they do it, because the rest of the characters that are Japanese speak in their native tongue. I think all the criticisms I've heard from a cultural perspective are overblown. overall, it's just a gorgeous little movie. It's a wonderful little film. So I totally recommend this one. Another great movie by Wes Anderson. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, Ready Player One topped off with almost $42 million, which is the highest opening for a Spielberg movie since Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull 10 years ago. And a lot of people think, oh, Steven Spielberg, he always has these big openings, but he's been doing a lot of smaller films, or his broad blockbuster type movies haven't been such. You know, something like the BFG, which kind of flopped, or even something like Tintin, which, you know, wasn't a huge hit, and part of it's the release and the cultural elements, because that's not really an American film that a lot of people recognize. Tyler Perry's Acrimony came in with a strong $17 million in second place. And then, you know, God's Not Dead kind of flopped. Less than $3 million outside of the top 10. So, you know, who knows? I predicted that. I said those movies, when you have sequels like that, you have diminishing returns. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is a Blu-ray that just came out. Actually, I think it came out last week, but I'm covering it this week. It is the collector's edition from Shout Factory of Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. A documentary crew follows an aspiring serial killer as they make a film about his evil methods.
Everybody thinks we just wake up one morning and start obsessing about a girl and start stalking her, killing everybody that gets in the way.
That does seem to happen a lot with you guys.
There are 11 exits from the first floor. Another 8 or 9 that might be manageable from the second floor. All the obvious weapons, a set.
You have no idea who you're dealing with.
This is one of those deconstructing horror movies. Long before you had a movie like Cabin in the Woods, you had this Rise of Leslie Vernon, which it plays off of slasher films. I mean, in this movie, characters like Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger are real people. They're not fictional characters. And so this is the one about a guy who is wanting to become the next sort of teen slasher villain. And it's basically a spotlight on him. And it's playing off of sort of the mockumentary style that was very popular, especially in the 90s and into the 2000s. This came out, I think it was made in 2006. It came out in 2007. But this has kind of got a little bit of a cult following, and it's nice to see Shout Factory giving. They've been doing a lot of like new additions to these cult movies, which is great, because it's nice to get these back out there. And even though this one's not like from the 80s, it still kind of has this cult status, which it's sort of like a niche of a niche, because of course I would imagine everyone knows who Jason from Friday the 13th is, and Freddy Krueger. I mean, those are in the pop mainstream, but fans of those movies are going to be drawn to this because it's sort of a niche audience of fans of the slasher movies. We'll see all the tropes and the elements to this. So while this is kind of a, like I said, a niche of a niche movie, it's still interesting and it's different. And even though it's kind of, it's not as new as it was when it first came out, it's a neat little film and it's a neat little deconstruction of the slasher movie genre. The new Blu-ray has a couple new features to it. It's got some new interviews, and it's struck from the digital intermediate to a new HD master. So it looks very good. But there's also the audio commentary, with the cast and the director. There's two commentaries, actually, one with sort of a moderated commentary. There's also a couple behind the scenes things about casting and deleted scenes. And of course, the theatrical trailer. Definitely worth picking up if you're a fan of horror movies, slasher movies, or if you just knew this movie was out 10 years ago and want to get it again on Blu-ray in a good format. So I'm going to have to say that Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other new releases on DVD and Blu-ray this week include Insidious, The Last Key, Father Figures, Basmati Blues, and Ballers Season 3. And that is it for this week. Next week I'm going to be talking about Rampage and Truth or Dare. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.